Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Jeanne Siminoff about her memoir, Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood. And we will hear all about the 50-plus Senior Olympics taking place here in Santa Fe. I'd like now to welcome Justin Clifton. He is the director of the Telluride Mountain Film on Tour. The Mountain Film in Telluride Festival is happening at the Lensic at 7 o'clock on Thursday night, the 20th of January, sponsored by Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mayor Charlotte.
So what is the festival all about? I've been there in the past, and there's so many different kinds of films.
Yeah, we're a pretty diverse festival, really kind of at our core. We're an activism-based film festival. We like to think of film as a conversation. We treat film very much that way. When we started the festival in 1979, it was really just purely a climbing festival and had grown and evolved over the years to the point now to where we deal with a lot of cultural and social issues, as well as still sticking to our core of being a very mountain culture, climbing-focused film festival, which I think you'll see all of those aspects at the Wild Earth Guardians show there on the 20th.
Now, the feature is Flathead Wild. What's that all about?
So the Flathead is one of the most pristine rivers left in North America, and there is a open pit, kind of mountaintop removal style coal mine that is being proposed right within the Flathead. And so this film really deals with this notion of this idea of extraction-based economy and what that's doing to these last remaining wild places, these places that really are the heartbeat of all of humanity, and we just continue to ruin them for small gains. And so the film itself really takes a pretty deep look at both this proposed mining project, but more importantly, this really valuable and wonderful ecosystem that is really threatened and endangered and will possibly no longer be what we understand it to be as human beings.
Do we see the politics in this film of the whole situation, or is it more really about the natural ecosystem?
They do a nice job of really focusing in this film on highlighting the ecosystem and trying to connect the viewer with this really beautiful place. Most people will probably never go to the Flathead. And I think that what the film does very well is it connects you visually and emotionally with this place to the point that even though you won't be there, you feel a connection to it, and it's something that you would want to preserve. Now, they certainly do get into the politics of the whole thing and looking at the mining project. But I think what's most valuable about this film is that it's beautifully shot, and they tell the story beautifully about this place.
You describe the film festival as a mountain film as a kind of as an activist type of festival, and over the years that you've been doing it, what do you feel have been the results, the actual changes that have taken place, the changes in consciousness among people who see the films?
Well, we've seen a lot of pretty positive change that has come directly out of the festival. We call it the domino effect of mountain film. One that comes to mind most recently, and this is more on kind of a social issue side of things. We had a film a couple of years ago called Making the Crooked Straight, which followed a guy named Dr. Rick Hodes, who has spent his entire life working toward helping children with disabilities get surgeries that they need and the help that they need. And he's gone so far as to adopt children to be able to get them on his own insurance so they can get surgeries that they need. And he was here at the festival and won a prize. One of the things that sets Mountain Film apart is that our top prize, rather than going to a film or filmmaker, actually goes to a nonprofit associated with the film. And his film won this prize, which is called the Mountain Film Prize, and it's a $5,000 grant. And that money went to save the life of a young girl named Mira. Last year, Dr. Hodes came back, and we had a film called Music by Prudence at the festival. And he was so moved by this beautiful woman who had this amazing voice but has been wheelchair-bound since birth, that he wanted to do something. And so what he did is he got a team of surgeons together during the festival that all agreed to provide this surgery for Prudence so she could. It's not going to help her walk, but it's going to make her more comfortable as a person and certainly will straighten her spine out and likely will make her a better singer as a result. And that surgery is now taking place here in the middle of this month. And these are the kinds of things that we see. We bring these stories and we bring these people to Telluride, and our audiences get moved to action. Sometimes those actions are actually raising money for awareness through our festival. We were able to engage people enough in the community here in Telluride to where they were donating millions of dollars to help protect and preserve the valley floor right here in Telluride. And I think it really speaks to, you know, what Wild Earth Guardians is doing and their notion to kind of protect and restore wildlife and wild places in the American West. It's really our missions blend so well together that it just makes us doing this show in Santa Fe that much more meaningful.
And Wild Earth Guardians does have offices in both Colorado and Santa Fe and is doing amazing work in the West. Some of the other films that are at the Mountain Film in Telluride Festival, which is happening at the Lensic this coming Thursday, Thursday of next week, the 20th of January, are the kind of films that if you don't like crazy adrenaline adventures, you better hold tight to your seat.
Yeah, to say the least. We have really some fantastic films. Probably one of my highlighted films for me personally is a film called Brothers Wild, which follows Timmy O'Neill and his brother Sean on a pretty amazing adventure up in the Ruth Gorge range of Alaska. It's just a funny adventure with these two very offbeat individuals, one of whom happens to be in a wheelchair. And then next on my list really I have two, but Last Paradise I love because it follows one, a local Telluride guy named Jeff Campbell, on an adventure down to New Zealand. And what's interesting about it is this is all happening in the early 80s, and it's guys skiing in jeans, and they're doing things that you see guys doing today, and they think they're innovative, but these guys were doing it in jeans and pretty low-tech equipment back in the day. It's a nice little snippet look back at kind of some of the history of adventure sports.
Where have these films been shown? Do you tour them all over the United States or beyond?
We do. We do about 70 shows a year, really all over the U.S. and a few international stops here and there. And that's 70 shows in about 60 different locations. So some locations will do multiple nights, multiple screenings.
Do you feel that you've been able to, in any way, bridge the divide that we see so clearly in the U.S. and particularly in the West between those who just believe in a kind of what looks like to me blinders on the side of your eyes way in extractive industries on the one hand and those who see the bigger picture of ecosystems in the other? Have you been able to show these films to people and open their eyes a little bit?
I would say yes. And I say that with the caveat that our main mission is to kind of provide this medium of communication in a fairly pure way, without necessarily putting our own bent on it. Obviously, the films that we choose, show a certain, bias from our standpoint in that we believe in the value of wild places and in the value of environments and cultures. But we do these shows across cultural boundaries. We do a show in Lubbock, Texas, one of the most conservative places I've been in recent years, and the people there love the content and they eat it up. And it's we do it in like-minded communities as well. And I see the energy and the excitement from people across the board. really what I've seen is the opposite of what you see in mainstream media, and that is that, you know, America is not totally polarized and unhinged. You know, we have people on both sides of any issue that can see clearly the responsibilities that they have as individuals on this planet. And I think that's the beauty of this, is that really it can be appealing to anybody, no matter what your opinion. And, you know, my thing is always that I believe everybody should be fully informed on all sides of the issues, and we're presenting one side of that. So,
how do these filmmakers get funding to do all these films? These are all independent movie-making enterprises?
Yeah, most of them are, and they rely really heavily on donations, private funding, a lot of sponsorship funding. You know, some of the films that you'll see are by guys that started out really small and have actually built a fairly successful business for themselves, making climbing films and kind of finding funding around a very specific topic. Flathead Wild, for example, is actually by a couple of kayakers, guys that are professional kayakers, and they started a project called the Epicosity Project. And through that, we're able to get funding for this Flathead project. And so the funding really comes from a number of different areas, but nobody's getting rich on these films. This isn't Hollywood kind of budget stuff. This is dedicated, passionate individuals who are going out and doing really great work because they believe in it 100%.
Are they getting their films seen in other festivals as well?
Yeah, most of these films we see in other festivals throughout the festival circuit. You know, is pretty healthy for a lot of these filmmakers. If they've done a good job, they can actually see some income from winning awards and different things like that.
Anything else that you want to add?
Well, I'm hoping that people come out in support of Wild Earth Guardians for the show. They're certainly going to be entertained. They're going to be informed. The mission of Mountain Film really starts with what I think is a key phrase, which is to educate and inspire audiences. And that's really what we want to do. And the mission is longer than that, and we'll just call it the radio edit to educate and inspire audiences. I think that it's for a fantastic cause. Wild Earth Guardians works so desperately to protect and preserve what we all hold as valuable in the American Southwest. Really, I think that I couldn't be happier to partner with them. They've been fantastic partners in the past, and we're just happy to bring these films back to Santa Fe.
Justin Clifton is director of Mountain Film on Tour, and that festival is being shown. It's a couple of hours long?
So we have about 2 hours of film, so we'll probably be there for about, you know, 2.5 to 3 hours.
Right, with intermission, and Wild Earth Guardians,
exactly,
who's sponsoring it, will be talking a little bit. But it's happening at the Lensic at 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 20th of January. And for more information on Mountain Film, you can go to mountainfilm.org. Mountainfilm.org. And for more on Wild Earth Guardians, you can go to wildearthguardians.org. Justin Clifton, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we're going to go out with a song called Sun, Moon, and Stars by Mos Def.
Ladies and gentlemen, so good to be here with y'all. Give me some. No moment like now. It's now, only always. Boogie! A life is beautiful, life is real. Mathematics, the act still, the unfamiliar, the warm embrace, the family ties and the stranger face, the lightning's under the poppy steel, the what it is and the what is believed, the strong connection, desire, the need, the waking hour, the moment, the dream, the laugh, the murmur, the moan and the scream, the voice of reason somewhere in between, the one and all, the me and the we, the I and I, the thou and the thee. A man, a designer, child of the street. The daily chore, the impossible feat. The drum, the chorus, phenomenal beat. Easy to touch in the heart of the reed. The sweetest fruit at the top of the tree.
sun, the moons and the stars and the breeze. I'm coming to it.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're going to take a little break right now to hear from our beloved underwriters. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome to the program Jean Simonoff. She is author of the new memoir, Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood, and she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday, the 17th of January at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So this is a book that you wrote pretty much not only about your childhood, but kind of from a child's point of view as in terms of the writing style.
Right.
Why did you choose to do it that way?
That's the way it came forward. Because of the loss of my mother when I was 2.5 and not really having the language to describe what had happened or having any knowledge as to what really happened, I had repressed a lot of memories. And within the writing, with a pen on a blank page, all of a sudden, that child came forward. And it came forward in the voice of the child at the age at which the memories were repressed.
Now, did you go through a process of, so to speak, recovering memories from the first two and a half years of your life?
I would say I did.
Or it could be a process of creative imagination, I suppose. It must be some interesting combination of those two.
I think so. It's not automatic writing, but it's as if writing does writing. It just came forward on the page, and each time I would complete a portion of it, I would read it afterwards, and I'd say, oh my goodness, where did this come from? It's in my handwriting. It's with my pen, my notebook. But how does memory reform on the page when it has been hiding interior and dormant for so long?
Very interesting. And so you wrote this, and it's very much about, well, themes of loss and themes of anti-Semitism in World War II and post-World War II Los Angeles.
Correct.
What are your earliest memories of, first of all, just knowing that you were Jewish?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever not known that I was Jewish. I came from a religious family. grew up in the Highland Park eco-work area of Los Angeles. My forebears, my father's sisters and brothers, actually helped to physically build the synagogue in Highland Park. So, you know, I grew up through that, and I grew up just knowing that that's who I was, and very proud, very out about it.
At a certain point, one of your classmates, or one of your childhood colleagues, so to speak, what do you call them, playmates, accused you of killing Jesus Christ.
Well, yes, he did. That was Donovan, bless his heart. Yeah, it was, a very strange experience for a small child who didn't really know that much really about Jesus Christ. You know, having grown up in
considering you're, 6 years old or something?
Yeah, 6, 7 years old. And, never sang Christmas songs. Never really, as far as I knew, there was a Bible. It ended at the Old Testament. You know, and that was it. And all of a sudden, there's this little kid hollering at me every day to and from school, "You killed Christ, you dirty Jew." You know, what to do about that? How does one get around that? What does the small child who is me do to try to get away from this form of terror, or what could be called now in this day and age childhood bullying?
Right. And what did you do about it?
Well, I learned to run faster than him. I learned to protect myself from him by imagining that he wasn't there. Getting into that place where the child who was me is running away, and in my mind, I am trying to look for all of the salvation I can. I think about Yom Kippur, you know, the Day of Atonement, and how there's this big book. And in this big book, God decides, okay, you're going to drown. You know, you're going to die by fire, this, that, and the other. And as a small kid, I imagined Donovan drowning. And all of a sudden, it drowns out his voice. It takes me away from him. And in that moment, I learned to save myself.
How did your family respond when you came home and told them what was happening?
I don't know. It was like, in some way, they didn't really believe that it was happening. I don't remember getting any support. I remember the same child burning a cross on our front lawn. And years later, when I'm writing the memoir, before my mother's mind was totally taken with Alzheimer's, I said, "Hey, do you remember that time when that little kid that lived around the corner burned a cross on our lawn?" "Oh, I don't remember any of that." "Do you remember that he used to scream at me every day?" "Are you sure?" my classmates, my other classmates, believe me, didn't understand why they believed me, where my parents in some way, I don't know, maybe they thought, you know, I was a kid who made up a lot of stories. Maybe it was a made-up story.
At the same time, there's a little passage in the book where you talk about how your stepmother felt very safe as a Jew when she was growing up, which was well before World War II.
Right.
And in Los Angeles after that, it suddenly wasn't safe anymore.
I know, it's really...
Even though the United States was fighting Nazism.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange phenomenon. And my mother grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was the daughter of a rabbi who came, you know, to the United States, bringing his family to be free, you know, to practice his own religion, to be able to be out in the world. And yet, as you say, here we are in a little enclave in Los Angeles, where we're the only Jewish family. It's no longer safe to be there. The irony was just startling to me when I realized it.
It also raises the question, which I don't think you really go into in the memoir, but what is going on in the minds and in the families of little children like Donovan who learn to be expressively hateful at such an early age?
Good question, Mary Charlotte. I don't know what's going on. I think our parents are our role models. You know, I mean, we live in a world where there is a lot of hate. You know, somebody always has to be picking on someone else. And, I mean, here in Santa Fe, it happens, being Jewish, for several years, we had a guard at the door of our synagogue at the high holidays.
Really?
Yeah.
What had
yeah.
happened that made you feel the need to do that?
Just fear. Groups from the other side, you know, just doing malicious things.
I mean, had there been incidents?
I don't really recall anything specific, but just knowing, I mean, as a Jew, there's something built into my DNA where I'm on guard. It's like being in the trenches every day. You know, we see the same thing with gays, you know, with gays and lesbians, bashing and all of that stuff. You know, another form of discrimination that happens all the time today in our world.
Right. But I mean, I don't want to go into this too much, but you're putting guards up around the synagogue on the high holidays, even though there had not actually been any known incidents.
Just threats of incidents.
So people had called and threatened you?
Yeah. So what do you say? What do you do? Do you not, you know, do you do like a lot of the Jews did in Nazi Germany and say, oh, hey, nah, could never happen.
That could never happen, right? Yeah, yeah. We're talking to Jean Siminoff about her memoir, Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood. Another thing that happened, which was a great disappointment to you, was you wanted to have the bat mitzvah ceremony, and you were not allowed to.
Right. And this is...
Why was that?
This is 1952. This is in a conservative synagogue. You know, there's the Orthodox, there's a conservative, and the Reform, of which I'm a member now.
The Reform.
The Reform Judaism, yeah. And at that time, especially in my synagogue, and I think pretty much around the United States, girls just didn't do that. I mean, they didn't do that. And in my mind, I mean, I'm going to Hebrew school. I'm studying. I'm actually much better at all the prayers than the boys are. You know, and there's no doubt in my mind that I will have this rite of passage. And it doesn't happen.
The rabbi said no.
The rabbi didn't say no. The rabbi left. My parents felt that it would be just as okay to be confirmed as to be bat mitzvahed. Of course, in my mind, not so.
What happened after that?
Well, a long time went by. I think that in some way I lost some of my faith. You know, I went through rituals. I mean, we went to Friday night services. We benched left. We lit candles. We said the blessing over the wine. You know, we did all of these things that I did that were artifacts of Jewish culture and Jewish life, yet I didn't really feel totally part of it. And it wasn't until 50 years later that I went to a bat mitzvah up in South Lake Tahoe of my cousin Lizzie's, and all of a sudden, it just came to me. It's not too late.
And so you got bat mitzvahed in your 60s.
I did in 2002. And the miraculous and wonderful part of it was that my mother had Alzheimer's. It was hard. She went in and out of memory. At that time, she recognized her brother, which she hadn't recognized for 4 years. And in the middle of the service, my mother yells out, "That's my daughter!" You know, and it was like coming home. It was like that part that I didn't get to complete was fulfilled at that time, and I was able to move on with my life.
We're talking to Jean Siminoff about her memoir, Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood. As I was reading along, I was thinking, you have these stories of discrimination against you, little girl, you, for being Jewish. You have discrimination also from within the religion against you as a girl. And I wondered, and you were very religious. You loved Hebrew school. You loved Judaism. Was there in retrospect for you a connection between the discrimination against you and the strength of your connection to your religion?
I feel that I felt very strongly. I was a very strong secular Jew, yet part of what was happening left an empty space in me, and one that I really needed to figure out how I could fill. Discrimination, I don't know, it seems like it's always been part of my life, and yet it's never held me down. You know, and I feel very strong, and I feel that there's not anything that I really can't do. So does discrimination, loss, make you weaker? Does it make you stronger? You get a choice. For me, as I learned early in writing the memoir, Queen Stinky comes forward. And Queen Stinky is this little kid who's me, who discovers ways that she can get what she wants. You know, she discovers ways in which she is very strong. And up until that point in my life, I don't think I was aware that I had that Queen Stinky in me. You know, and here's this little kid who's really tough as nails. You know, and actually I invited Queen Stinky to come with me here today. So she'd like to say hello.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So the memoir is called Saving Myself. And I had to wonder whether the saving happened in the process of writing or whether you felt like you really had found a way to save yourself as a young child.
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. I think that I did find a way to save myself, and that I was a very strong little kid, a very resourceful kid. I was an only child, and so I learned to be strong. And so saving myself came forward. The book had many other titles, but that was the one, in writing the memoir, appeared to be what was the reality of my life.
Jean, is there any maybe part from the book that you'd like to read?
Yes, I could start. You know, since the book starts at the beginning, I could start with the beginning.
All right.
Okay, the beginning is called 1943, The First Death. Even though I was there, I can't remember if I caught a glimpse of the flashing red lights or heard the siren when my mother died, whether my father picked me up or I stayed in my crib for what seemed like forever or just a second. Life after that became a blur. I only remember one small artifact at a time. Sounds, screams, siren, father's wail, breath, then no breath, grasping wife for husband, beloved, then no beloved. There is only a mass of tangled feelings with the Los Angeles summer heat carrying the scent of jasmine in through the open window. No words, without a map to follow. My father a beacon, then no light.
Jean Siminoff from her memoir, Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood. You spoke at the beginning about the process of writing, which was basically taking pen and paper and going into what, as you talk about it, sounds like almost a trance state, looking at what you read later. How did you then shape that into a memoir?
Well, good question. I decided that the format would be good to just put it in chronological order, because I had I had several small vignettes written since, you know, time comes back in on itself like a parabola. Nothing was written in any particular order, and in order to make a coherent flow, I started by putting in the dates and then let the book flow from there.
Jean Siminoff's memoir is Saving Myself, A Los Angeles Childhood, and once again, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Monday, the 17th of January at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, or in the evening. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. So all of you, I hope you show up at Collected Works at 6 o'clock on Martin Luther King Day.
Right.
To bear witness and to help each other open our hearts.
Thank you. And Jean Siminoff has chosen a song to go out with. It's by Debbie Friedman, who was a Jewish folk singer who passed away just earlier this week. The song is called Mi Sheberach. I'd like now to welcome Karen Roth, Barbara Cohen, and Paul Zisman. They are all part of the Santa Fe 50-plus Senior Olympics Committee. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So the Senior Olympics 50-plus is an event that opens in March. Registration is already happening. What's it all about?
Well, this is we're one of the few states in the nation that has local senior games. And state games. The Senior Olympic program itself is a national program. It's called National Senior Games. And we have been holding senior games in Santa Fe for, I think, over 25 years
now. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
When you say we're one of the few to have a local event, what do you mean?
Local games, most states don't have local games. They just have a state game, and therefore it allows fewer people to participate. But we like our locals. Every county in New Mexico has local games. Ours begin March 15th and go through the end of May. We offer everything from archery to swimming and everything in between. So I'll let someone else describe some of the events.
Are most of the people who participate people who have been athletes in the rest of their earlier parts of their lives?
Not necessarily. I think that there are a lot of people who do. I'm a swimmer, so they swim for relaxation. They've never competed before. But they hear about Senior Olympics, like I heard about Senior Olympics from the chair here that just spoke, Karen Roth, in the locker room of Salvador Perez, and I thought, wow, that's something I would like to do. So the nice thing with the local games is they're kind of low-key, and people can just go. They need to register now. January, today through February 25th. And you register at the Genevieve Chavez, at the Meg Center.
At the what?
Mary Esther Gonzalez Senior Center on Alto Street. So that's the thing that I have to think about. I register now, but I compete in mid-March to end of May,
okay,
depending on what my sport is.
Now, are these events subdivided by age? So in other words, a 50-year-old would have a tremendous advantage over a 75-year-old in whatever the event is, or most of them. Let's not count necessarily talent show and shuffleboard, but some of the other events like track and field and swimming.
Yes, the events are categorized by every 5 years there's a change in with whom you compete with. But sometimes we don't have so many people that we can fill in all the age categories, so we combine them. And in some events it's kind of loose, and people are grouped more by ability than ages. So it's strictly speaking at the local level, I'll say it's kind of loose, but at the state level, national level, it's very strict that you have to compete within your age group. So it goes like from 50 to 55, 54.
Yeah. Does the Santa Fe Senior Olympics then feed into states and nationals? How does that work?
Well, if you qualify at the local level, which because there are not that many athletes, it's almost everybody qualifies for a state event. And then state games are held the end of July. And those who are then interested in going to nationals are every 2 years in the odd year. And several of us compete in nationals as well.
What do you compete in?
I compete in swimming and triathlon.
And when you think about the kind of speeds and accomplishments that you have at this age, how different are they from people competing in their 30s and 40s?
Well, at nationals, it's very, very strong competition. A lot of fast people. But I've placed at nationals, and I consider myself an average swimmer when you're looking at national swimmers. But that's not really, winning isn't everything in Senior Olympics, because we've all enjoyed meeting people from all different backgrounds, and it allows the average person to free throw a basketball. And that's the sport. To sprinting and track, archery, golf, bowling, all kinds of opportunities.
Badminton? Do people take up badminton just so they can compete in this kind of thing?
Yes.
And now we're offering pickleball. Maybe Paul could tell us about pickleball.
Pickleball is a sport that was kind of developed for older people who would like to find an alternative to tennis and perhaps badminton. It's played with a pickleball, with a wiffle ball indoors, and you have a tennis net in the middle of the court, and you play with things that the paddles that look like ping pong paddles, but they're larger, so you can still get spin effects on the wiffle ball, and you still serve, and it's a lot like tennis, but it's slowed down a lot, and so it's a great way to still keep up with the racquetball sport, even though maybe you can't compete with the 30-year-olds like you mentioned before, and maybe you don't move as fast, but you want to try to stay at your optimum fitness level. And so that's why a lot of people do the Senior Olympics too. I do badminton. I want to keep my reflexes as up to par as I can, and so badminton I found is a great way. It's fast, but yet it's not as fast as maybe tennis, the way the younger people play.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, serves going 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, you can in badminton, you can do that too. We do have tennis. I was just using tennis.
You can serve 90 miles an hour in badminton?
Yeah.
I think not.
You can. It's considered the fastest racket sport, actually. If you ever see it in the Olympics, you'll see what I mean, you know, when they play at that level. So
cycling is part of it also, bowling. Now, horseshoes. And talent show. That doesn't seem like an Olympic sport. That's just something you kind of throw in for fun.
Yeah, I happen to be the event manager for the talent show. It's competitive, but not in the sense that people are all wound up about it. but we do give medals, and it's a way of people to perform and demonstrate their talents. And we have dance and comedy routines and guitar playing. Some people read their poetry and do different vocal presentations. But our definition of sport is a bit wider than, say, you know, the National Olympics or the International Olympics. So we can include more people.
Do you have any old-time comedians from TV and radio who get involved?
Not
that would be
state.
Good. When you get to be 50, we'll invite you to. Maybe you can.
What, am I a comedian now? We're talking about the 50-plus Senior Olympics that are taking place here in Santa Fe. Now, anything else that you want to let people know?
I would like to let people know that at the Mary Esther Gonzalez Senior Center and on a few dates at the Genevieve Chavez Center, they have a book that has all the dates of these sports. So you'll know that racquetball is on Friday, March 18th. So when you do register now through February 25th, you want to pick up that local games book and check to see when your sport is competing so that you know you're available at that time.
And you can also find it on the internet. Are there ways that people can get together with each other and practice before all of this? Do you have classes and so on set up?
Do you want to say what she, Joyce?
Yeah, that's really the whole idea. I mean, our goal is to help people participate in sports so that they can enhance their fitness levels. And so, yeah, almost all the sports, there's opportunities for that. For example, pickleball is meeting on Wednesdays at Fridays at 9:30 at the shop.
Did you have to call it pickleball?
I don't know where that. Oh, I know where that came from, but we don't have to go into it.
and
I'd also like to say that Tai Chi is another of the new sports that we have. Pickleball is new and Tai Chi is new.
Can you compete in Tai Chi?
In the same way that you can compete in the talent events and in gymnastics, yes. But some people really emphasize the competition. Others, like myself, I'm into it more for the fitness part. Like I do Tai Chi and badminton to keep coordinated and keep my aerobic levels up to par. So, you can actually compete in Tai Chi, but we don't. It's not stressed as much. What is stressed is that you do get, like you mentioned, the regular practice, and the weekly practice at the recreation centers or different schools around town.
I would like to add that with each registration, the cost is $12. Also, once you've participated in your event, you get a 15-punch free pass at the Chavez Center. Good all year, and last year we had over 400 people who actually participated in Senior Olympics in Santa Fe County alone.
Karen Roth, Barbara Cohen, and Paul Zisman are with the Santa Fe 50-plus Senior Olympics Committee, and if you Google any combination of Santa Fe Senior 50-plus Olympics, you will find it on the web, and you can also, once again, register by the 25th of February at
Mary Esther Gonzalez Senior Center on Alto Street.
Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.